Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. Today, this will be one incredibly empowering hour, because I'm going to be answering some of the mail that I just opened and was reading after our six-hour overnight sister station KPFK show that I do every Wednesday morning from midnight to 6 a.m. West Coast time, 3 a.m. to 9 a.m. East Coast time. And I've done it for 30 years. One of the questions was about enzymes, and a person just didn't understand, do they have to take supplemental enzymes? They thought that all the foods that we eat contain enzymes, so why this talk about enzymes helping? I'll answer that, and I'll give you all the enzymes you should be taking. Also, for those of you who want to modulate your immune system to help you overcome allergies, to stay stronger in the presence of viruses and bacteria, which we're all exposed to, but we don't all get sick, I'll give you the latest. And the latest is tenofend. Tenofend, T-I-N-O, teno, fend, F-E-N-D. It's an important addition. I'll give you the background on this. Yesterday, I did a little more in-depth discussion about health, what we call the Classroom on the Air segment. It goes into greater depth. Sometimes, regrettably, I have to deal in the language of hard science and medicine, but always end up summarizing it in lay language, just so that we can understand how our body functions in health and disease. I had some additional questions. I'll answer them in lay language, but they deal with how do you really simplify what you need for a healthy heart. Also, a brand new study, and it's a stunner. You know how they're always using the argument? GMOs, genetically modified organisms, corn, soybean, and other products, we need them because, well, there's more nutrients. Really? Well, we just have a great new study that says just the opposite, and I'll share that with you. Broccoli, very important for our healing process, and fibrous barley and mushroom, they contain a nutrient that we should have, reduces our blood sugar levels. I'll share that with you. Also today from our public health segments, the psychotherapeutic school system. I talked about it years ago. I'll talk about it today. Pathologizing childhood. I'll share some thoughts from John Whitehead and the Rutherford.org. Also, how Big Pharma is bringing forced drug tests to a state near you. The fix is in. They already can control most of the state legislators who are corrupt, venal, sociopathic, and dysfunctional. I guess who else would run for that office? So now they want to drug every single employee in the United States. Why? Well, because they make money from it. How much money? Into the billions. Who's behind it? All those details coming to you through Think Progress, Nicole Flatto. Also today, a commentary from Professor James Petras. I want to share my insights additionally on how we have no rule of law at all for all people. Oh, we have it for we the people. We just have no rules of law at all for the major banks, the most powerful organizations, and individuals in the world. None. And if time permits, on our environmental segment, it took 1,600 years to build the Andean glaciers. 1,600 years. They're gone in 25 years. This is a startling insight, and I'll share more on that with you. Let's begin. I'm going to start with this comparison and quote the claim, there is no difference between GMO corn and non-GMO corn. We've heard that. That's why the FDA said Well, they're virtually identical, so we don't need to do safety studies on GMOs. Not true. Yesterday, we have the latest study that shows just the opposite. Here are the results. GMO corn has 14 parts per million of calcium. Non-GMO corn, the kind you and I would eat, 6,130 parts per million. Well, hold on. That's not possible. That's a 437 times greater amount of calcium, and we need calcium. Yeah, no, the figures are correct. Let me repeat that. 14 parts per million calcium in GMO, 6,130 parts per million in non-GMO. In corn, magnesium. Now, we really need magnesium, 2 parts per million. In the non-GMO corn, 13 parts per million, 56 times more. In manganese, 2 parts per million. In non-GMO manganese, 14. Look at the levels of formaldehyde and glyphosate in the corn. The EP standards for glyphosate in water in America is 0.7 parts per million. In Europe, it's 0.2 parts per million. Tests show organ damage in animals at 0.1 part per million of glyphosate in water. The corn, the GMO corn, 13 parts per million. Not what we're told will damage our livers, 0.1 part per million or 1/10 of a part, but 13 parts. In another study by Dr. Huber, reported 97 parts per million of formaldehyde, embalming fluid, showed to be toxic in ingested animals, and the corn had how much? 200 times that. That is why the animals, given a choice, will not eat it at all. They can smell the formaldehyde. So on all levels, you've been lied to. This administration, the president, all of Congress that supported the Monsanto, the lobbyist, they all lied to you. GMO is dangerous. We know it. And it's time that you stopped eating anything that is GMO produced. Broccoli is good for you. And according to this latest study, it was published in the new Phytologist, it says, through the integration of a B. vicola that enhanced sulfate assimilation, this is the scientific part, it has healthier compounds in the broccoli. This simple. They're now looking at super broccoli and very high yields and that have enormous amounts of healthy phytonutrient glucophoran in. And that is very important. There was a 3-year study, and they found that this new broccoli shows enormous potential for having super high amounts of the anti-cancer nutrients. So you'll be hearing more about this. So all the more reason to be eating your broccoli, juicing your broccoli, and eating broccoli sprouts. Fibrous barley and mushroom has beta-glucans. And why should you have beta-glucans? Because they reduce glycemic response, and that's important. Published in the Journal of Plant Foods for Human Nutrition, this study found, quote, fiber content of extruded snack can be upped while the glycemic response is lowered with the inclusion of beta-glucan fractions from barley and mushrooms. And now the beta-glucan fractions are very important because it helps stabilize our blood sugar. Now consider this. We have about 100 million Americans, all told, who are either diagnosed as diabetic or who are pre-diabetic. So anything that can help bring that sugar level down to a normal is going to prevent heart disease, cancer, kidney dysfunction, depression, and inflammation in the body. So why not do this? they want to put the fibrous material that has the beta-glucans in junk food. That's what they're saying here. They're saying if you put the beta-glucan fibrous material from barley and mushroom in junk food, then the junk food doesn't have the high push against your glucose. Well, A, you could use coconut syrup. That is a low glycemic, all-natural, nutrient-rich sweetener. So you don't need to use this. Why not do the right thing? Just encourage people to eat more mushrooms and barley. How about a barley cereal? Or how about mushroom barley soup? Now that combines them both. Mushroom barley soup is delicious, easy to make, doesn't take much time, and helps lower your blood pressure and lower your cholesterol and lower your blood sugar. Three great things it does from a delicious tasting soup. So that's important. For those of you who would like to benefit your brain, ease depression, a new study shows that krill oil, K-R-I-L-L, by taking it every day, it can help boost learning and working memory. This was done in lab animals. It was published in the peer-reviewed journal Lipids in Health and Disease. Quote, there is clearly potential for krill oil to aid in the management of depressive disorders while avoiding sedative effects, meaning drug effects, and that's good. When you're practicing a sport, like tennis, basketball, soccer, you have to constantly be thinking while in motion. And that's a good thing. It helps sharpen your reflex action. Here's a study that confirms that and how it benefits people. This is from the University of Granada. And it was published in the very respectable PLOS ONE medical journal. It says, new scientific evidence seems to confirm the famous Roman saying, mens sana in corpore sano. Researchers from the University of Granada have demonstrated that people who normally practice sport have a better cognitive performance than those with bad physical health. More specifically, the results of this research indicate that the former have a better sustained attention span, they react more rapidly to an external stimulus introduced randomly while carrying out a monotonous task. Their autonomic nervous system also appears to work better when dealing with cognitive loads over a longer time. So, it's this simple. Every day, when you're exercising, you're actually making your brain better able to deal with the environment that you're in versus if you didn't exercise. So one more good reason to exercise. I'm sure that many of you have probably noticed what I've noticed many times. And having interviewed about 4,000 senior citizens in the last 4 years for a new documentary on Getting Old in America, I'm seeing today's older generation are far less healthy than previous generations. And therefore, you try to go through why. Is it lack of exercise? Is it stress? Is it environmental pollution? How many people today are more likely to spend time in front of a television or a computer or on a cell phone? Are they eating more processed foods? Why? Is there less social contact? Is there a reduction in the family? Here's the latest study from the European Society of Cardiology, published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. Quote, results from a large cohort study suggest that exposure to metabolic risk of cardiovascular disease is increasing and that the adult generation of today are less healthy than their counterparts of previous generations. Despite their greater life expectancy, the adults of today are less metabolically healthy than their counterparts. That's the conclusion of a large study in the Netherlands which compared generational shifts in a range of well-established metabolic risk factors for cardiovascular disease, and the prevalence of metabolic risk factors and the lifelong exposure to them have increased. They studied 6,000 people in 1987 till today. Now, what does this mean in lay language? Well, it means that today we are more overweight or obese, we have more hypertension than previous generations. And think about it. I can remember that people smoke, that's bad. They socially drank, that's bad. But they also were more physically active. That's good. They spent more time with their family. That's excellent. There was always an aunt, an uncle, grandparent, a sibling, someone to relate to, and it was expected on a regular basis. In my family, every Sunday, we all met, sometimes as many as 30 people, aunts and uncles. We had a very large family, 19 all told on my mother and father's side. And that does not include the children like us and our nephews and cousins. So there was always an interreaction. There was always laughter. That's very good. People didn't overly personalize everything as they do today. There was not the job insecurity, and there was not the cost of living crisis that we face today, where you have to have two persons in a family working long hours just to pay bills, and even then they can't do it. The average cost of a mortgage was under 2%, and most people prided themselves in budgeting. My family was financially conservative. I am financially conservative. I do not believe that I should be buying what I cannot afford on things I don't need, accumulating debt that then distracts me from the quality of my life and what I should be paying attention to. So as a result, when everyone else had a television, I didn't. When everyone else had the big co-ops and apartments and the other authors that I knew who were all friends of mine were living nicely, and I was happy for them. I'd go to their houses, you know, good for you. And I had a one-room studio and raised my family in it and learned how to appreciate what I had instead of being stressed by what I didn't. It was that simple. And people sometimes confuse an austere existence for a poor existence. Austere, yes. Poor, not at all. And that's how I grew up. That's how my brothers and all the people I knew grew up. Today, most people overvalue their possessions. Most people live a highly consumerist, obedient life. Most people are overweight, have cardiovascular conditions, because look at the food they're eating. Fried food, fast food, too much protein, too much carbohydrate, too much sugar, soft drinks and coffee. And then one day they wake up and they may have gotten through medications. They may have gotten to 68, 70, 75, but they're very sick. They have multiple diseases and they don't have a quality of life and they're stressed to the max. That's the reason that we have this. Now, following up on that principle that we're not eating right, living right, and we're not processing our emotions right today, to the person who asked yesterday about what could you do to help your father, who is not a believer in taking vitamins, not going to change anything, I'll make it simple. Make a shake of his favorite flavor, if it's chocolate or vanilla or strawberry. That's easy to do. In the shake, put about a teaspoon to a tablespoon of coconut oil, the same with flaxseed oil. Throw in a handful of walnuts. Throw in a tablespoon of pomegranate juice, concentrate. That's not the juice, that's the concentrate. That means that they've evaporated about one half or more of the actual water out, so you're getting far more of the healing nutrients in the actual pomegranate. Do the same thing for grape, blueberry, and dark Montmorency cherry. Then throw in some superoxide dismutase, the gliadin complex, about 500 milligrams, pomela from the pomegranate, and then if you can find the pomegranate, which you should be able to, pomegranate seeds, give that. That will do an enormous amount of good to help the endothelial system of your father. It'll act as an endothelial defense. It'll help with blood flow and the age-related endothelial dysfunction that we frequently see. And it's not expensive, easy to do. And then, if he is adapting to it well, then add in your vitamin E, 400 to 800 units of natural mixed tocopherols, 200 units of the tocotrienols, 2,000 milligrams of curcuminoids from curcumin, and that will take it even further in healing inside the body and repairing DNA. Okay? Now, to the person who wrote me about enzymes, and they heard that enzymes are very important and they want to have a way of helping their body heal with enzymes. First, understand that every fruit and vegetable, grain, nut, seed, legume, and pulse, and tuber has enzymes that are species and plant specific, which means that the enzymes in an apple are not the same as in enzymes in a peach. You have some common enzymes in fats, you have some common enzyme in carbohydrates, and some common enzymes in protein. And then, but the moment we process the food, the moment that we overheat the food, dehusk it, we're destroying most of those enzymes. Hence, enzymes are the catalysts of life. Enzymes are the spark plugs in a car. We need them. So when you juice each day, you're flooding the body with one glass of juice. One 16-ounce glass of juice is more enzymes than the average American would get in probably a week who eats a standardized American diet. So here are the enzymes that are necessary, not just to help in digestion, but understand that human studies show that enzymes improve digestion and minimize post-meal glucose surges. That helps also. Most of your enzyme-rich foods are rich in fiber and healthy fats, and these are broken down differently, and the enzymes break them down differently. So protease, cellulase, lipase, those are the categories of enzymes. Protease is for protein, cellulase is for carbohydrates, lipase is for fats. And the ones I would say are the most important to have would be the pectinase, hemicellulase, beta-glucanase, phytase, chymotrypsin, trypsin, lipase, cellulase, acid protease. That's especially people who might have GERD or gastric reflux, people drink coffee, protease S and protease SP, and xanthelase. These are the enzymes. I just gave you 12 enzymes that will help cover the full spectrum of what the average person needs to not only help in the digestive process, especially if you're not digesting food because you're lacking intrinsic factor, good hydrochloric acid levels. Maybe you spent your life overeating. Maybe you spent your life eating and drinking at the same time. Big mistake. Big mistake. Big mistake. Unless the meal is a liquid meal, like a soup, always make sure that you distance by at least 15 minutes so the stomach can empty and rebalance itself. Because here's how it works. Let's say that you have some protein in the stomach. Let's say you've eaten a hamburger, and it's a cheesed hamburger, it's a cheeseburger. So you've got fat, and you've got protein, but you also have the bun, and the bun is a carbohydrate, going to be broken down into simple sugar. There are three different times for digestion. The fastest digestion will be the bun. It can digest in about, an hour. The meat will take anywhere from 3 to 5 hours, and the cheese, the fat, could take 6 hours. That's assuming that you have good, healthy digestion. But let's say now that you had a cola on top of that. The cola is going to change the pH and the acid level in the stomach. It's going to dilute natural enzymes that the body secretes. And that means then that the body has this floating of all this food and doesn't know what to do. And so not to burn itself, the stomach keeps secreting a protective mucus barrier. And then finally, it starts dumping this mess from the stomach into the large intestine, the first part of the intestine, the duodenum or duodenum, and that deacidifies it. But it's not chewed up. It's not fully masticated. It's got little pieces. Big mistake. Those big pieces are not going to be properly digested. As a result, if the intestine is leaky, and most are, you'll be absorbing some of those large pieces and the body immediately attacks them because the body cannot differentiate a foreign agent like a partially digested piece of steak from a pathogen. And hence, every time you eat, your immune system goes into hyper-extended overload. And you literally exhaust your immune system. So therefore, when you need your immune system, when you have a legitimate attack by a bacteria or virus or parasite, the immune system's not there as it normally would be in the same percentage to help you. Hence the reason why slow food, taking your time, not drinking with a meal, but wait to drink before a meal or drink an hour after a meal. Then don't eat the simple sugars because they're going to really adversely affect your stomach. That's where you get gas because there's no mechanism for the C to part and for all the simple sugars to go right through the stomach. So you're going to cause fermentation and fermentation leads to gas. That's why you have to chew your food thoroughly, eat in good combinations. Don't overeat. Better to have more frequent small meals than to have large meals. The whole idea of a large meal is not in balance with our anatomy. And that's why when you have a glass of apple juice with some, let's say, lemon in it, you're giving a perfect boost to the enzymes needed to help digest fats in protein. Now, for those of you who would like to boost your immune system, to have it strong, to help you, there's a lot that we can do. There is a plant called Tinospora. And the Tinospora, T-I-N, Tino, Spora, S-P-O-R-A, it's a traditional Ayurvedic plant, and it's standardized anywhere out there, and it significantly enhances your immune parameters. It modulates the immune system. It helps support the activity to regulate immune response, and especially the macrophages, the protective cells in our body. It also helps to limit the number of eosinophils, which are a type of white blood cell, already within the normal range, and it provides polysaccharides to help optimize the immune system's normal defenses, including neutrophils, a type of white blood cell function. So that's just something else that you can add. Generally about, I would say, 500 milligrams will make a difference. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. Half hour's worth. Back in a moment for other issues. Please stay with us.
off this land of broken dreams. I have visions of many things, but happiness is just an illusion filled with sadness and confusion. What becomes of the broken dreams?
Nice to have you with us, everyone. Broadcasting live from our studios in New York City and video streaming, I'm Gary Knoll. Just a quick program announcement. Every Sunday, we'll be meeting at 9 a.m. at 90th Street and 5th Avenue, right across from the Guggenheim, to help people get into top shape, the best shape of their life. Reverse that aging process. Feel better, look better. And there's a lot of people. We were packed last week, and we're just going to get more and more over the next 4 weeks. Now, we stop allowing new people to come because we'll be too far along in our lessons. And these are not just lessons about race walking and jogging and running, but they're also about life. And then every Monday evening, the running group gets together and we premiere a new film. We premiered a new film this past Monday. We're going to premiere another one. I have 9 films finished waiting for their premiere date, so they get an advanced look at them. So we're going to be doing a lot of stuff. We're also going to travel around the world this year, this summer, and do some races in other countries. We thought Paris, Rome, be some nice places to go and do some marathons. Doesn't matter what shape you're in today. Don't look in the mirror and say, I couldn't do that. Yes, you can. We'll get you in shape. So show up, 90th Street and 5th Avenue. No charge, it's a public service. Been doing it since 1977. Now, also, I have just 2 more premiere showings of Seeds of Death, April 30th, 7:30, Theater for the New City. You got to get a reservation, 212-254-1109, 212-254-1109. And they already fill up one theater, so they've moved it to their largest theater. Woodstock Community Center screening of Seeds of Death. I'll be there. Lecture afterwards. Saturday, April 27th, 7 p.m. There's not a reservation. It's first come, first served. But any information you need, just call 845-697-7420. 845-697-7420. And I'm going to save having dinner until afterwards, and then normally I have to rush back to the city, but I decided it's just too much. It's 6 hours of driving to get up there and come back, and then for the showing, so I'm just going to spend the evening, and we'll take over a restaurant and have a chance to chat afterwards. I'm concerned that we in the United States do not practice the rule of law. You and I do. We're held accountable. If you doubt me, consider this. If you were to engage in money laundering, which is illegal, both at the state and the federal level, and you were found guilty, you will go to jail for a long time. And yet one bank alone engaged in over $800 billion in money laundering, paid a fine, did not have to acknowledge guilt, no one was held accountable. That is how corrupt our system has become. Yesterday, I reported that the UN High Commissioner on crimes said the United States is engaging in illegal activities and is breaking crimes against humanity and specific treaties. Yet the American media did not report on it. I checked, nor would anyone in Washington do anything except laugh. We have this notion of legal imperialism and international law. We also have the legal foundations of war, crimes, debt collection, and colonization. By now, we're familiar with imperial states using their military power to attack, destroy, and occupy independent countries. Boatloads of important studies have documented how imperial countries have seized and pillaged the resources of mineral-rich and agriculturally productive countries in consort with multinational corporations. In fact, I dare say that you will rarely ever find any war committed where it is just those in power seeking to maintain power Almost always it is seeking to control resources of some nature and using the multinational as the people who forge this alliance. Financial critics have provided abundant data on the ways in which imperial creditors have extracted onerous rents, royalties, and debt payments from indebted countries and their taxpayers and workers, employees, and productive sectors. What has not been examined fully is the overarching legal architecture which informs and justifies and facilitates imperial wars, pillage, and debt collection. While force and violence, especially through overt and covert military interventions, have always been an essential part of empire building, it does not operate in a legal vacuum. Judicial institutions, rulings, and legal precedents precede, accompany, and follow the process of empire building. The legality of imperial activity is based largely on the imperial state's judicial system and its own legal experts. Their legal theories and opinions are always presented as overruling international law, as well as the laws of the countries targeted for imperial intervention. Imperial law supersedes international law simply because imperial law is backed by brute force. Whoever has the largest military, whoever is willing to inflict the greatest pain, always wins. And then they say they did it because they were legally mandated to do it. The very judicial processes, including the appointment of judges and prosecutors who interpret international law, investigate international crime, and arrest and sentence and punish guilty parties, are under the influence of the reigning imperial powers. In other words, the application of jurisdiction of international law is selective and subject to constraints imposed by the configurations of imperial and national power. International law at best can provide a moral judgment and a not insignificant basis for strengthening the political claims of countries, regimes, and people seeking redress from imperial war crimes and economic pillage. To counter the claims and judgments pertaining to international law, especially in the area of the Geneva Protocol, such as war crimes and crimes against humanity, imperial legal experts, scholars, and judges have elaborated a legal framework to justify or exempt imperial state activity. Empire building throughout history is the result of conquest, the use or threat of superior military force. The U.S. global empire is no exception, where compliant rulers invite or submit to imperial domination. Such acts of treason on the part of the puppet or client rulers usually precipitate popular rebellions, which are then suppressed by joint imperial and collaborative armies. They cite imperial legal doctrine to justify their intervention to repress a subject people in revolt. And while empires arose through the direct or indirect use of unbridled force, the maintenance and consolidation of empires through requires a legal framework, and legal doctrines precede, accompany, and follow the expansion. Let me give you one example. In the mid-1920s, a group of three individuals met in England in a country estate, and they decided that it was time that they join forces collectively to take over all of the major oil fields of the world. There were not that many at that time. And they succeeded in doing that. One of those individuals was the personal representative of John D. Rockefeller, the senior, who had to break up in the early 1900s his Standard Oil. However, of the sum, I think it was 27 corporations that were broken up, he still controlled all of them. He was America's first billionaire. And $1 billion then would represent about $50 to $60 billion today. But his power exceeded his wealth. And let us not forget that in America, we assume that celebrity equals wealth and that equals power. I can promise you this, the most powerful people on earth are people who have no celebrity status. And they don't always have enormous wealth. But they are masters of how they use their power, protect their agendas and the wealth that they do have. And that's what they did. Look at an example of that. Look in Iran. Look at what happened when British Petroleum became the exclusive person or group that was manipulating the oil in Iran. They gave the Iranian government and the monarch that ran it for his personal use, and those are the princes of the court, millions of dollars. They kept billions of dollars. And it was only when the people realized that they were still suffering, they were in gross poverty, that Moshedek and some others in their democratically elected parliament rose up and said, this is unfair. In the process of doing that, the Shah of Iran appointed as prime minister Moshedek. Moshedek then said that we're going to nationalize British Petroleum. British Petroleum then sought out the help of the CIA and Alan Dulles and General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, and they then created a coup. The coup led to the overthrow of Moshedek and the destabilization of the entire government, and then the reascendance of the Shah of Iran. The Shah of Iran was 1,000 times more brutal, if you could imagine that, than Hussein. He murdered hundreds of thousands of his citizens. There was the most feared police state, yet he was our despotic ruler. He became fabulously wealthy, and only later, when the population once again rose up and threw him out, did we realize that we had, backed the wrong horse. But everything that was democratic was ruled non-democratic. Everything that was corrupt was ruled normal. All of the laws of corruption were accepted. The laws of diplomacy and democracy were rejected. That is how much power a centralized imperial nation has. And we, along with the British, were responsible for that debacle. So you could say today that when we're fearing and flailing against Iran and trying to get Israel to engage in a preemptive strike, we created that situation. And anyone who has a true knowledge of history knows that to be the case. Judicial officials are not only instruments of closely related imperial political and economic powers, they also instrumentalize and in some cases override officials from other branches of their own imperial government and economic sectors. Judges with ties to particular financial sectors may rule in favor of one group of creditors, thereby prejudicing others. In a recent ruling, a New York judge ruled in favor of the demands by minority creditors that the Argentine government make full payment on long-standing national debt, in prejudicing already agreed-upon payments to the majority of the creditors who had negotiated an earlier debt restructuring arrangement. All judges are suspect of gross imbalances and biases, and many are out-and-out corrupt. Imperial legal doctrine has always played a central role in justifying and providing a basis for the exercise of international terrorism. Executives such as U.S. President Bush and Obama have been provided with the legal power to undertake cross-national targeting, assassinations of opponents, using predator drones, and ordering military intervention in clear violation of the international law and national sovereignty. Imperial law, above all else, legalizes aggression and economic pillage and undermines the laws of targeted countries, creating lawlessness and chaos among its victims. Imperial law and judicial rulings form the basis of imperial subjugation on the assumption that the world legal systems are multi-tiered. Imperial-centered legal systems supersede those of less powerful states. Within each tier, there are further refinements. Competing imperial legal systems adjudicate in favor of their partisan political and economic elites. Imperial clients who obey their imperial overlords are favored by imperial laws, while imperial laws are applied against their adversaries. In conclusion, clearly, in a world of imperial systems, there can be no independent judicial bodies who abide by universally accepted legal codes. Each set of judicial authorities reflect and actively promote policies favoring and extending their imperial prerogatives. There are rare exceptions where a judge will rule against a particular imperial policy, but over the long run, imperial law guides judicial opinions. Imperial legal doctrines and judicial decisions set the groundwork for imperial wars and economic pillage. The empire's legal experts redefine assassinations, coercion, torture, and arbitrary arrests as compatible with the constitutional order by claiming imminent and constant threats to the security of the imperial state. Law is not simply part of the superstructure reflecting the power of economic or political institutions. It also guides and directs political and economic institutions committing material resources to implementing imperial doctrines. In this sense, imperial rulers are not lawless. As some liberal critics have argued, they function in the accordance with imperial jurisprudence and are faithful to the legal doctrines of empire building. It is pointless to argue that most imperial leaders trample on constitutional guarantees and international laws. If an imperial ruler pursued a constitutional agenda, eroding imperial prerogatives, or even worse, applied international law to prosecute those carrying out our brutal imperial policy, he would be quickly condemned for dereliction of duty and immoral behavior and impeached or overthrown or killed. Indeed, I give an example of Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and John F. Kennedy as three examples of people who are killed because of the rightness of their beliefs. Do you think that anyone, I repeat, anyone in power today is anything other than an imperial courtier of the court? These are the people who profit. From Bill Clinton to Obama, they all profit. And that's why you have not seen a single person held accountable for the crimes against humanity in Wall Street, the dereliction of duty, the crimes against humanity for the Bush administration, nor will you. I just wanted to share some insights into what happens when you misconstrue law for what type of law is it. And we live by imperial law. Time for TalkBack, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Here's something from our issue segment, and I want to thank Lawrence Davidson for sharing this from Consortium News. The Whys of American Ignorance, this is short, and it talks about how a editor-in-chief of History News Network published a book entitled Just How Stupid Are We? And it said that the majority of Americans are ignorant about major international events, knew little about how their own government runs and who runs it, were nonetheless willing to accept government positions and policies even though a moderate amount of critical thought suggested they were bad for the country, and were really swayed by stereotyping, simplistic solutions, irrational fears, and public relations babble. But it added something that I found particularly unique here. And this is what caught my attention. Because we all know how stupid most people are. You know, I would rather debate a brick. All right, here is quote, that American ignorance is explainable does not make it any less distressing. At the very least, it often leads to embarrassment for the minority who are not ignorant. And then it goes into the fact that most people do not question anything unless it specifically impacts them. How many times have I told you, if we really care about unions and you're a union member, then why aren't you getting your union to join other unions to have general strikes against poverty, against crime and by corporate America, against the corporate welfare state? But you don't see that. And it's because we are also intrinsically selfish. That's a thought. And we'll say hello to David from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi, Gary. You know, this is an interesting topic. I'm in my 50s, so I have only a certain amount of historical knowledge of some of what you're talking about. But as I understand it, you know, if you read some of the famous books about the organized crime and how they came to power, they've handled a lot of financial management for, I don't know if it's 100 years yet, but it's at least, if for example, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, if you read those biographies on him, it makes it plain that he was in the pocket of organized crime for many years. He didn't even believe that organized crime existed, or he claimed he didn't believe it existed. And so he allowed organized crime to get a really rolling head start from from the Roaring Twenties when they were bootlegging whiskey and Al Capone back in the almost 100 years ago.
That was one part of it. The other part of that story is that early on, one of the godfathers of one of the New York families found out about J. Edgar Hoover's sexual proclivities and photographed him without him being aware of it, and then held that as blackmail because he was such a political animal and an opportunist Machiavellian. He would not recognize La Cosa Nostra. He would not recognize till after the hearings, the Dewey hearings and the Kefauver hearings, or the Kefauver hearings were the principal ones, that showed and proved with two of the individuals coming forward who were the first on records to say, yes, there is La Cosa Nostra, and this is how it works. And that was a surprise to everyone. But it wasn't a surprise to Hoover. Hoover knew all about this, but he just wouldn't say anything about it. And otherwise, though, I accept that we have allowed other people to direct our domestic policies to tell us what we should invest in and what we should buy and what we shouldn't buy. And in effect, they've told us that our economy is good. It is not. For at least 70% of the American population, it is not only not good, it will never be better, and it's only going to get worse. For 30% of the population, it is great and is only going to get better. And I predict this. I predict in the next 36 months, Americans who want to have a better life, or Americans who have a secure life, will then gravitate into several thousand oases, meaning green zones, where they have safety, there's security, there's quality of life, standard of living, where there's no ghetto, no poor people. And the only poor people that you're going to find are people who are brought in to service them, tend their lawns, cook their meals, do their laundry, and exit. And that'll be true in cities. You cannot defend a whole city, but there'll be parts of cities, and they will maintain their services. And you'll see a shift in the public consciousness towards wanting to be in those places. The real estate market will go up in those places, and everywhere else, you're going to be living in a very dilapidated and dangerous place. Maureen from Los Angeles. Hi, your turn.
Hi. Okay, my question is it true that there were known aggression side effects of the prescription drug that was being used by the Colorado man on trial now for the movie theater shootings?
Yes. But let me go one step further. And I refer you to our website. We found that every single shooter for the last 20 years, major public shooter, and all the school shooters were all on psychiatric medications, and many of them on the same ones, and not a single word about testing for psychiatric meds, the dangers of psychiatric meds, the legitimacy, the efficacy and safety of psychiatric meds, not a single word. That's how much power the pharmaceutical company has. And instead, we've made all about, register gun owners. Well, let me ask you something. How many criminals, gangbangers, are going to go and say, I intend to use this gun to kill someone, to rob someone, or shoot someone. I want to register it. I want to do it legally. The stupidity of how we're approaching this is just mind-numbing. All right? Thank you, Maureen, from Los Angeles. I'm looking. We have time for one quick one. Peter from Pennsylvania. Peter?
Yes. Hi, Gary. Good afternoon. You know who I am. I'll just be really brief. Successful financial advisor, retired 2 years ago, starting changing everything 7 years ago personally. That's why I retired and quit my practice and gave it away. I want to start a proactive movement here in Pennsylvania, in the Philadelphia region, instead of driving 2.5 hours to always seeing your shows and visiting you and LeMahon and everything else. What would you suggest?
Simple. Just put up your ideas of what you would like to do and the resources you need to do it, human resources, what the outcome hopefully will be and how it will benefit the people who come on board. Then put that up on the internet, and then have other people within your area, within a reasonable area, reach out to you. Then have a meeting of those individuals and explain what you're trying to do and how that can make it a better world and what their responsibilities would be. You have to start at the grassroots, and all grassroots starts with an idea and inviting people to share their input and then forming a larger idea once you have everyone else's idea on the table. Okay? Thanks for your call, Peter. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Now it's time for TalkBack, 888-874-4888. We'll take some more calls now, and let's say hello in studio to you, to Lou Anne Panessi. Hi, Lou Anne.
Call me Utrice there, huh?
Utrice Panessi.
Yeah, that's right. That's close.
Lou Anne Leeds.
I'm going to get off the beaten path here a little bit, Gary, and I have an email here from Sonia, who's here in Manhattan. And she says, 12 years ago when I was 16, my older brother introduced the idea of organic foods into my parents' home, which we all integrated. Since then, I've gone through college. I moved back to New York City and finally figured out the path I had to take to achieve my goals. Now at the age of 28, I'm finally cluing myself into how to best utilize technology. I've downloaded all of your podcasts since they became available and listened to them daily. She says, though I'm enrolled in a conventional nutrition studies program in Manhattan, I'm 99% of the time on board with your information, so I'm excited and interested to be learning so much. And she says, so first, I want to thank you. Secondly, I used to listen to you 12 years ago on NPR. I've seen many of your photos, but only in the past few weeks did I start wondering what this intelligent and hilarious individual looked like live and in the flesh. So I started watching some YouTube.
I will not get naked on the air. I don't think I will. Maybe I will.
Not going there. I started watching some YouTube videos, got on the website, and wow, are you and your listeners right? I clicked on Gary Null's Dance Party 2 from 1984, and at the 3:20 mark, Gary comes on. As a 28-year-old woman, I am both impressed and shocked at his dancing. Never would I have imagined the speaker on the podcast to move like that. She says, "Nup said." So I just wanted to share that with you. Now you've got 28-year-olds, Gary, listening to your podcast and watching your body dancing at the 3:20 mark.
By the way, I want to thank the people who sent those videos in. Some are a little crude in the darkness, and you know these were not professional cinematographers. But we have, when I came back off the trip, I had about 18 more upstairs. And I'm just now going through them in the nighttime to see if they're good enough to put up, you know, if people can actually see some. And I just saw one last night where there must be 1,000 people you actually see, where you see them laughing and dancing. And I thought that'd be great for people to see what they looked like back then and how they were enjoying a party. So I'm going to put these up in the next week. And the ones, I think we have 7 or 8 up there now. So go up there and take a look at them, and it's fun. And I'm going to be doing a new dance party.
You are?
Yeah, we're just waiting on the date and to celebrate a new book coming out in the next couple of weeks.
I think you should wear some of the outfits you wore in those videos from the 80s. We thought those clothes
I would
were
love
cool.
to. I would love to, but I can't get them back from the Smithsonian Institute. And that's enough of Lou Anne Panessi. Let's say hello to Utrice Leed. Hi, Utrice.
Oh, that's funny. Hello, Gary. being very carefully tended to in the Smithsonian. That's great. Well, today we're going to be talking about the budget, and we'll be talking about yet another Obama drama unfolding in Chicago.
Oh, good. I look forward to that. By the way, I'm going to be doing a commentary one day in the next few days about what really went on with Valerie Jarrett and Obama as community organizers, because we heard, oh, they were community organizers helping the poor. Not true. They both work for a major for-profit group and that got rid of a lot of quality housing so they could put up, you know, their subsidized housing that they benefited from. The real true story about how they were doing this back then.
And well, you beat me to it.
No, I'll wait. You do it, and then I have my own. You do it, and I'll come on afterwards. All right?
No, it's good. It's a good story. Somebody brought it to my attention, too, and I started looking at it. It's very, very eye-opening, so I can't wait to hear your story on it.
Great. And I did not know until this morning that Death by Medicine was airing last night on Channel 79 and Channel 43 on Brooklyn Community Access Television. If you know in advance when these things are airing, please let me know, and I'll share that with the audience so they can watch them. Have a nice day, everyone, and stay tuned now for Utrecht.